The world is supported by LegalZoom. We're halfway through the year, but it's never too late to get started on things you want to accomplish. LegalZoom can help you complete some of the things on your to-do list with their friends and family discount. For more information, visit LegalZoom.com.
Trump gets the royal treatment today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. On his first day in the UK, President Trump was met by the Queen and by mixed reviews from the British public.
I'm British and American, and I voted for President Trump, and I absolutely adore him, in fact.
He's misogynistic and racist, and I don't think that the UK should be welcoming him.
Also, young people in Russia are volunteering more, and the Russian government is keeping an eye on them.
The state wants to absolutely control anything that resembles political activity.
Plus, scientists use seals to collect key data on Antarctic ocean temperatures.
That means that in the winter, we get data from below the sea ice, and we don't have to be here, which is quite nice.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Britain rolled out the red carpet for President Trump today. There was all kinds of royal fanfare, from a 41-gun salute to honor the president to a visit to Buckingham Palace with the Queen. But before all that, before Air Force One had even touched down in the UK, President Trump managed to upstage his own visit with a series of tweets insulting the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. We begin with the world's Orla Barry in London with more on President Trump's first 24 hours in Britain.
He met with the Queen at Buckingham Palace. Himself and Melania, the First Lady, were there. And Ivanka Trump, apparently, was up in a balcony watching all of this. It was all pomp and ceremony, etc. And the President inspected the Guard of Honour along with Prince Charles. And then they went on to have this private lunch with the Queen. Then this evening, it's this lavish banquet. That's the sort of the big and most lavish part of the three-day state visit.
I remember Michelle Obama, just by gently resting her hand on the Queen's shoulder, talking with her a couple of years ago, caused quite a stir in the British public. Trump didn't step out of line. He followed all the protocol and etiquette to a T.
Well, there's one funny incident today which is being analysed, and it will sound quite ridiculous, but it looks like there was a fist bump between President Trump and the Queen. It's being analysed very, very carefully, but from what I can see, it looks like when the Queen meets you, she greets you by sort of holding out her hand and sort of bending her hand a little bit, if you know what I mean. Almost as if you're going to hold it gently or maybe bend down to give it a kiss. So she held out her hand gently. He tried to grasp it with this big handshake that he tries. But whatever way he did it, it looks like that both of their fists sort of bumped off each other. So now everyone is saying that the Queen and the President fist bumped.
That is quite a concept. So back to Sadiq Khan, the London mayor. Trump, as you said, hadn't even landed and the tension was rising between him and Mayor Khan. What was going on there, and has anything come of that?
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, this whole trip has been about etiquette and protocol and how you need to behave towards the royal family, etc. And the first thing that the president does, even before Air Force One has touched the tarmac, is tweet out a rather unpleasant tweet about the mayor of the city that's arriving into. It seems that he may have been tweeting in response to this article that Sadiq Khan wrote in a newspaper here, in the Observer newspaper, yesterday, where he talked about the language used by President Trump being similar to the language used by 20th century fascists. So it's been going over and back for 4 years now, effectively. And it looks like it's not going to end anytime soon, because Sadiq Khan then tweeted out a video of his response today.
President Trump, if you're watching this, your values and what you stand for are the complete opposite of London's values and the values in this country.
I got to say, Orla, the Trump fire often seems to just feed itself. Leading up to this visit, the president came out in support of Boris Johnson, the controversial former mayor of London and former British foreign minister. How significant has that announcement been during his visit today? Like, what are people saying?
I mean, it's relatively significant in the sense that Boris Johnson himself has just launched his leadership bid for the Conservative Party and future Prime Minister today as well. It hasn't been a great week up to this for Boris Johnson, so things are turning for him, I guess, in his mind. Some people will see it as helping Boris Johnson in his campaign. Boris Johnson is talking about if he wins that he will go for a no-deal Brexit, and if we have a no-deal Brexit, our relations with the US will be even more important and we need to foster this relationship even stronger. So therefore, if I have a great ally in the US president, things will help the UK economy, etc.
There's a lot to look at during this three-day visit, including Trump's meeting with Theresa May about the Chinese telecom company Huawei. That's supposed to be a big one. Give us a preview here. What's at stake with that meeting?
The reports are that Trump will say to the British government and to Theresa May that Washington may limit intelligence sharing with the UK if the UK goes on to allow Huawei to build part of its new 5G network. The interesting thing, of course, the meetings tomorrow, they're between UK and US business leaders, and there was to be a lunch between Prime Minister Theresa May and Boris Johnson tomorrow, and it has been confirmed that the one-on-one is now not happening. So I guess President Trump isn't really too interested in meeting a Prime Minister who will be out of office by Friday. And Theresa May may not be too interested in meeting the US President, who has been praising Boris Johnson, her greatest nemesis, so publicly.
Orla, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
I mean, this is about the ongoing relationship between the United States and the UK. It's an establishment of continually friendly relations, despite who our president is.
That's author Lionel Shriver. She's an American living in the UK. You might know her novel that became a movie, We Need to Talk About Kevin. She tends to write about big issues that rock both the US and the UK. Shriver is pro-Brexit, so she shares that with Trump, but otherwise she is anti-Trump. So I was curious about her take on the American president's visit this week and what it means to her as an American living there.
It's tricky, you know, being an American expat while he's president. Though I don't find that the British, at least, tend to blame me, for example, for who my president is. For some reason, when George Bush was president, there was much more of a contamination factor. Whereas the assumption here runs that, of course, you don't like Trump. You seem like a sane person.
Trump is expected to make more comments on Brexit and Theresa May. May is resigning as prime minister this week. Trump has weighed in before on Brexit. He's very pro-Brexit. How does that look from the UK, having an American president kind of like coming in very strong on this very divisive issue in the UK?
I don't think it's helpful. And that said, I also did not think it was helpful when Obama came over and did exactly the same thing. Now he invaded on the other side of the debate. But I didn't think it was really his business to push the referendum one direction or the other. And likewise, it's not Donald Trump's business to intervene in the election of a new party leader for the Conservatives. And it's not his business whether or not the UK leaves the European Union. Now, as a supporter of Brexit, which I realize is not very popular in the United States, I could live without Donald Trump's being on my side.
So how do you reconcile that? You're pro-leave, you wanted Brexit to happen, but you don't support Trump, who is also pro-leave.
That's the point. I don't have trouble reconciling those positions in the slightest. I didn't vote for Trump. I wish he were not my president. But the truth is that the United States and the American people would never in a million years join an organization that was supranational and whose laws superseded our own. It would never occur to us. And I get a little frustrated with American liberals who think that the idea that the UK might leave the EU is the most terrible thing that ever happened in the history of the world. Well, at the same time, they would never have their own country join an organization like the EU. It's completely hypocritical.
You were talking earlier about there's still this relationship between the UK and the US. There's cooperation there. What do you think Donald Trump wants with this visit to the UK?
Well, I think he enjoys the implicit elevation of pomp and circumstance.
Do you think maybe he's just using the pageantry as a backdrop for his own gain?
Well, of course, these events are about mutual gain. They're about solidifying the relationships between the two countries. One of the reasons that Theresa May was comfortable in having the Queen ask Trump for a state visit is that at least the conceit is that these are two states coming together and not two world leaders. It's not supposed to be personal. And it better not be personal, because some of the other people that have had state visits in the UK have been the likes of, you know, Mugabe and Ceausescu. And even Xi Jinping got quite an elaborate state visit. And his human rights record is highly dubious, and that's being generous. So it's supposed to be formal. The formality is partly a cover for real differences in values and differences in political opinions.
Lionel Shriver, an American writer living in the UK, the author of the book We Need to Talk About Kevin. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You might have heard that one of North Korea's top negotiators was executed late last week, ostensibly because the U.S.-North Korea summit in Vietnam earlier this year failed. The execution made headlines all over the world, but just a few words of advice when it comes to any news from North Korea, take it with a grain of salt. The World's Patrick Wynn has been following this from Bangkok, particularly on the main character here, chief nuclear negotiator Kim Hyok-chol.
The giveaway that the guy was not in a labor camp or executed was him appearing in public at a concert with Kim Jong-un. So he's certainly not dead. It all started because there's this newspaper in South Korea that has a history of starting execution rumors. It's called the Chosun Ilbo. It's a conservative paper. It's quite popular, but they continue to do this. They will publish these reports that are based on an anonymous single source. But that's really not good enough. The American media jumps on it and spreads it and will always say, according to South Korean media reports. Well, according to what type of South Korean media? This paper also said that Kim Jong-un executed his ex-girlfriend, who was a famous singer, because she apparently made a sex tape. Then she appeared on television. It's the exact same thing playing over again, and this has happened with other top officials as well.
Is it always through this South Korean outlet, Chosun Ilbo, that these stories pop up?
No, it doesn't have to be just them, but they're a serious repeat offender. Sometimes it can be a reckless interpretation of North Korean state media. So there was a report that you may have seen swimming around the internet saying that North Korean government says unicorns exist and we've proved their existence. Well, no, that's not what it said. There was a piece about a fictional creature from North Korea's past mythology that was very badly interpreted. So it's this myth about how duped and gullible North Koreans are when, in fact, it just points out that we're the ones who are gullible. Even things that are true and are very bizarre and are very fascinating and are going to lead to sensational reporting because the facts are themselves sensational will get tweaked, and it seems like media can't help but add that extra layer of absurdity. Kim Jong-un really did have his uncle executed, was a very powerful figure in North Korea. He didn't have them fed to starving dogs, as as a lot of tabloids would have you believe. You know, you can't just call North Korea. You can't get them on the phone and say, did this happen? If you come up with a wild rumor and spread it around, it's hard to actually check with North Korea to see if it's true. And that gives media a chance to run wild.
Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty opaque country. And yet, as you say, there are these stories that seem outlandish. And occasionally they are true, like Kim's half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, getting killed by two women in the Kuala Lumpur airport with a nerve agent. I mean, how do you deal with what's real and what's fake in a state like North Korea?
That's a really good question. You know, as someone who reports on North Korea, I've been very lucky to meet quite a few North Koreans, and I just try to really have my guard up against stories that sound too sensational to be true. Wild things happen in North Korea. Honestly, wild things happen in every country, but we have a lot of trouble in the United States humanizing North Koreans. Through this job, I've been very lucky to meet quite a few North Koreans. So I try very hard not to be a part of the problem. I try very hard not to repeat anonymous one-source stories that pop up in South Korean media, because who knows what agenda is behind those stories.
The World's Patrick Wynn, thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Scientists turn to seals for help collecting ocean data in the Antarctic winter. That story just ahead here on The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you live in a coastal city, your community's future might depend on what happens in West Antarctica. Gigantic glaciers there reach out from the continent into the ocean, and they're being melted from below by a layer of warm water. The meltwater from these glaciers could raise sea levels and change coastlines around the world. The World's Carolyn Beeler recently spent 2 months on a research ship in Antarctica with scientists studying that warm water. They deployed robotic submarines and dropped instruments off of the side of the ship to gather data, but they also used something else, seals. Here's Carolyn.
Just off the west coast of Antarctica, a very big elephant seal is hauled out on a very small island. He's about 1,500 pounds, the length of a small car, and he smells like hot garbage. Ecologist Lars Bouma is standing face-to-face with the seal on the rocky beach. He's eyeing his jowls and bulbous nose to see if he's finished shedding his fur yet.
So I want to look at the head, at the underside of the neck.
When the seal bellows, his hot breath hits Lars in the face.
You hear the amount of air going in and out.
Lars works for the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He and three other scientists are out here hoping to attach sensors to seals to track the ocean's temperature as they dive.
So when the seal comes back to the surface, the data is transmitted in real time back to a ground station back home.
This data will teach scientists about the seals themselves and help them learn how fast warm water is melting West Antarctica's glaciers, a melting that could change the shape of our coastlines forever.
That means that in the winter, when it's minus 40 degrees, pitch dark, we get data from below the sea ice, and we don't have to be here, which is quite nice.
Still molting on the head as well. Still very fat.
He needs another 2 weeks.
Turns out this seal hasn't finished molting yet. If Lars put a sensor on him, it'd just fall off with his old fur. So he finds another candidate, a smaller, sleek Weddell seal, about 100 feet down the beach.
The head is molted, so we want to put a tag on.
But first, Lars has to catch the 650-pound animal.
So we catch it in a net. It will move. We will move. After a couple of minutes, everybody is exhausted, and the seal will settle down.
That net is more like a giant canvas bag with ropes for handles. Lars and another scientist grab it and try to slide it over the seal's head. He looks up at them and twists around. After a few minutes of this strange dance, the scientists get the bag over the seal's head to subdue him and inject him with anesthesia. Lars says this doesn't hurt the seals, and the sensors don't impact their mating or survival. I'm actually struck by how tenderly he and his colleague Guy Bortoloto treat the animal as they kneel beside him in their neon orange snowsuits.
I don't know, I like to think that they are our allies on this.
This kind of seal dives about a quarter of a mile underwater. That's right around where a layer of warm water that's melting the glaciers of West Antarctica starts.
Every time I see and think about these guys helping us, I think like how lucky we are that the biology of them fits perfectly to fill the gaps that we need, like of data.
With the seal under anesthesia, Lars glues the sensor to the back of his head. It's about the size of a smartphone and a couple inches thick with an antenna that looks like a unicorn horn. After about half an hour, the seal starts to come to and he shakes a little bit.
It's a side effect of the drug.
But Lars says the seal is fine.
I will just sit in front just in case that even the drug stayed, he's not going for the water.
Lars keeps an eye on the seal until it's safe for him to slide off the ice at the edge of the island and swim away. It's weird to see this and think about how differently we used to treat seals down here 200 years ago.
Men who were going to hunt the seals were dropped off on the islands with clubs and knives.
This is Beth Moore, the curator at the Nathaniel B. Palmer House in Connecticut. Palmer's the guy who the ship that took me to Antarctica was named after. He was a sealer, and sealers in the 1800s used to club southern fur seals to death to avoid damaging their silky pelts.
If the clubbing didn't work, they would then pull out some long knives and pierce them, being careful not to tear at the fur.
Demand for this fur was so high that by the early 1800s, more accessible seal colonies had already been wiped out.
Every year, they were having to go further and further south in the South Atlantic to find the seal breeding grounds.
That is what brought some of the first humans down to Antarctica. And that includes Palmer, who's one of the people credited with first seeing the continent in 1820.
So he wrote down in his logbook, and we can read the log entry.
Palmer was out scouting for seals in November of that year when he spotted a bit of land he didn't expect.
He basically says, I'm looking at something. It's not an iceberg. It's a landmass. And it's not on my charts or maps, so I'm going to write down where it's located. But I'm going to do what I was sent to do, which is look for seals.
Sealers nearly wiped out the entire population of southern fur seals during the 1800s. On some islands, it would take them more than a century to rebound.
I didn't realize the seals.
Back on the ship, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, Lars Bouma shows me what his seals have been up to. He attached sensors to a dozen of them over several long days in the field.
I have a main page here, which is a very simple
Lars pulls
page.
Up a map on his phone. It shows the near real-time paths of his seals. They shoot out in different colors like fireworks from the islands where he found them.
For example, this is a Weddell seal. We were talking about that.
He shows me the temperature data from her dives.
And you see blue is cold water, red is warm water. This seal really dove into the circumpolar deep water, into the warm water that's at greater depth.
This layer of warmer water has long existed in the deep ocean, but now it's being forced up toward Antarctica. Scientists think changing winds are to blame and may be linked to climate change, but they need more data to know for sure. Data like what the seals are gathering. Today, seals in Antarctica are protected under international treaty. Lars had to get permits and go through ethical reviews to work with them.
I try to treat them like humans. They have their own lives, they have families. So it is a big ethical question.
This, of course, marks a big shift in our relationship with nature since the days of Nathaniel B. Palmer.
We always thought of the ocean as being this unlimited resource, and hunting seals was part of it. And more recently, we discovered it's not an unlimited resource, and we really have to take care of it.
Lars hopes the more precise sea level rise predictions coming out of this research will help give us a better sense of the larger changes we're causing in the natural world.
Understanding the melting, the potential sea level rise, really helps us to better protect ourselves and all ecosystems.
The seals Lars tagged will swim around through the Antarctic winter, collecting data until their sensors fall off during their next molt. For The World, Carolyn Beeler.
Follow One Elephant Seal's deep dive and see the data it sent back. That's at theworld.org/seals. And if you're not following us on social media, here's something you're missing, a visual quiz on the science Carolyn just shared with us. Test yourself. That's on Instagram, at PRI The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Russia, more and more young people are doing volunteer work. But if they question the Russian government and the process, watch out.
You will immediately become a foreign agent. You will be accused of God knows what, to the point where they can just throw you in jail.
That story is just ahead here on The World. We begin a special series on Russia today, about young Russians specifically. Generation Putin, the Russians who've pretty much known only Vladimir Putin as their leader. I went to Russia recently to report this, and my partner producer was Daniel Offman. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Marco.
I got to say, you were the perfect guide for this assignment.
Yeah, well, I grew up in the U.S., but my first language is Russian. My parents are both from Moscow. They grew up in the Soviet Union. They came here in the early 90s, just before I was born. But the Russia that they left behind is completely different from the Russia that we saw during our trip.
We're going to start today with a story about volunteering. John F. Kennedy, of course, had the line on that.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
He said that in the spirit of getting young Americans involved in service, right? Well, the same thing is starting to happen in Russia now, but not because the Kremlin is pulling a JFK. It's because the Kremlin is absent in many areas of civil society. So today we're going to meet two very different groups of people that we spoke with on our trip.
Yeah, we visited something called WoofFest, which is this event where volunteers were trying to get people in Moscow to adopt stray animals. Illustration number two, and a big contrast here, the Committee Against Torture. These volunteers are shining a light on a problem, the problem of violence on inmates and detainees in Russia. And in both examples, the government is essentially absent. So activists and volunteers have to step in.
So our first day in Moscow, we went to this community center. There's a Sunday farmer's market out back. And inside the center...
What is the onomatopoeic for a dog barking in Russian? Is it wolf?
No.
What
it's guff guff.
Wolf Fest was in full swing. This day it wasn't about dogs, it was Cat Day at Wolf Fest. It looked like an animal shelter, but with pizzazz. Wolf is an NGO, a non-governmental organization, so most of their funding comes from grants and donations. Today, though, the organizers had also gotten sponsors like Purina and Fresh Step Litter to help out. There was even this kind of cat adoption talk show going on. Each time a cat got adopted, the scoreboard was updated, and the MC of the event would sit down with the new cat owners for a quick interview.
Вы счастливы? Какие мысли в голове сейчас вообще? Я не знаю.
The MC thanks the new cat owners and pushes the crowd to adopt more cats. There were dozens of Wolf volunteers who helped organize the event. This is Arina Malinovska.
Наш фестиваль является реально большим шансом для того, чтобы большее количество кошек заметили.
Our festival really increases the chances of more cats and dogs being noticed and adopted. There's this great atmosphere out here of kindness. It's like a mini holiday. That's why more pets are adopted during these events compared with adoptions directly from shelters.
Arina is only 20 years old, but she's been volunteering with Wolf for a while.
So you've been doing this since you were 15. Why spend hours of your life not making any money to take care of animals?
My volunteering story started when I adopted a dog from a shelter. I understood that even I can help make a difference and that it's not as hard as it seems. I understood that if I don't do this, no one will do it for me. All the volunteers here think this way. They say, if not me, then who?
I'd heard about the roundup and euthanizing of stray dogs in the southern Russian city of Sochi before the Olympics in 2014, so Wolf Fest was an encouraging sign. Here was a group of volunteers determined to do something about this stray animal problem, and they're actually able to make a difference. You remember, according to the event organizers, Daniel, about one-third of the animals get adopted as a result of events like Wolf Fest.
Right, and this may not seem like a big deal, but it is. For us growing up in the U.S., the idea of helping out at a shelter, visiting an old age home, or assisting at a soup kitchen is normal. This was not always the case, though, in Russia. Volunteering in this form simply wasn't a thing. But the sense that we got from someone like Arina is that, especially in big cities like Moscow, volunteering these days is actually cool.
The history of Russian civil society and civil activity is a subject for a good 1.5-hour lecture or a good scientific article.
This is Ekaterina Shulman. How would you describe her?
She's a highly regarded political scientist based in Moscow who knows a lot about volunteerism and civil society in Russia. She believes that this volunteering trend started in the mid-2000s, when many Russians were starting to feel more financially secure than they did back in the 90s.
Another trend that facilitated this process was the information revolution, the cheapness and therefore the affordability of mobile phones, which helps people to connect and stay together, to share their views, and then to discover that they have common interests.
And then in 2010, she said, another shift, two big natural disasters in Russia, catastrophic floods and wildfires. Regular citizens dealing with these disasters realized what they were doing was actually more effective than what the government had to offer.
This was exactly the moment when the growing Russian civil society met the corrupt and low effective state and discovered that first state didn't have enough resources, commitment, values, just plain money. Since then, a kind of quantity became quality.
So as a result, Shulman says this is the reality that the Russian state has created.
It desires to kind of outsource a number of social responsibilities which it cannot or is not willing to undertake to NGOs.
That's on one hand, and on the other,
the state wants to absolutely control anything that resembles or threatens to become political activity.
They want control. They don't want to get embarrassed by a bunch of nosy volunteers.
Which brings us to the Committee Against Torture. And for that, we traveled from Moscow to the city of Nizhny Novgorod.
Station, Nizhny Novgorod.
We arrive at the train station. We make our way towards the city center. Nizhny Novgorod has its own Kremlin, like the one in Moscow, and it so happened that we got there in the middle of a military rehearsal for the annual Victory Day parade. The triumph of the Soviet Union over the Nazi occupation in 1944. When we were in Nizhny, tanks were rolling through the street. Thousands of troops, male and female, from what seemed to be every branch of the Russian armed forces. Against this backdrop, we have an appointment on the other side of the city to meet with the head of the Committee Against Torture.
The Committee Against Torture has been around Russia for 19 years now. It's an independent NGO that investigates torture cases and helps torture victims across Russia. The idea is to hold the government accountable because in many cases, the government just ignores these cases. As a result, the committee is under constant pressure. And since 2012, that pressure has only increased.
What happened in 2012?
Well, that's when Russia passed something called the Foreign Agent Law. And even though the committee isn't foreign, the law says they engage in, quote, political activity, and therefore have to register as foreign agents. The pressures even led to violence. For example, the committee has offices in Chechnya that have been destroyed on multiple occasions. That's one case from the summer of 2015. Masked men in this video are using sledgehammers on the building, broken glasses everywhere, and onlookers cheer on as another masked man rips away at a security camera.
Yeah, and as we found out, it's really this culture of impunity that prompted Igor Kolyapin to fight it. He's the director of the Committee Against Torture.
У нас везде в Российской Федерации не очень хорошо с законностью.
Here in Russian Federation, we have problems with lawfulness. There is this idea that the law is one sphere and the real life is another.
Kolyapin's story is the story of the Committee Against Torture, what they do and what they want Russian society to be.
I
was always an individualist since I was a child. This is part of my personality. I support teamwork, discipline, institutions, government, but I've always believed that this is all in place for individual freedom.
Igor was in his 20s when the Soviet Union fell and he went into business. For him, that was his freedom in the new post-Soviet Russia. But quickly, things shifted.
Fire inspectors, sanitation inspectors, other inspectors would show up like every day to businesses. and they would basically threaten them. They would say, give me this amount of money, give me a piece of your business, give me some of your products, or else you won't pass your inspection.
Basically, it was an extortion racket, pure and simple. Igor says it was a new cancer that was taking over Russia. So he, a couple of his business friends, and some up-and-coming politicians started the Nizhny Novgorod Society of Human Rights. They would help anyone who ran into problems with corrupt officials. But then Igor found himself in trouble.
В один прекрасный день меня задержали сотрудники полиции.
One day, out of the blue, I got arrested by the police. I got accused of stealing a crazy amount of money. I was beaten 24 hours straight. They beat me to pulp. The policeman beat me so bad that later the prison refused to accept me.
That was the winter of 1992. Igor was kept in solitary confinement for 3 months, and then he was set free. All the charges were dropped. While he was in prison, though, his business had collapsed. But he says he had an epiphany.
Я понял одну очень важную вещь. Вот пока я там сидел...
Igor mentioned that when he first started making real money as a businessman, his dream was to have a beautiful home with a helipad. But after his experience with the police,
я больше не хочу иметь дом или вертолет.
I no longer wanted to own a home or a helicopter, knowing that I live in a country where at any moment the authorities can just show up and take everything away from you while beating your head in and forcing you to confess to something that you didn't actually do. I can do without a helicopter or all those other things. What became important to me is knowing that I'm fighting against this.
And that's when he founded the Committee Against Torture.
There is a federal agency called the Investigative Committee of Russia that's supposed to do just that, investigate cases of torture. But according to Igor, there are a couple of big problems. First, most victims simply don't report their cases. And second, for those who do report, the vast majority of them are rejected outright by the agency.
If you go to the website for the Committee Against Torture, there's a running tally of successful cases. So their work has established 194 cases of torture and led to convictions for 144 officials on charges of torture and other illegal use of force. Considering that all these cases could easily have been rejected by officials in the courts, 144 convictions is pretty astounding. But there's a catch. This is not an annual statistic. It's a result of 19 years of work. Igor knows the committee could do more. They could work on a case-by-case basis and probably help more people. But Igor wants real systemic change. That's how he thinks of his volunteerism. It's the only way he can imagine his work having any sustainable effect, just like the good folks we met at the Wolf Fest. As Igor explains, it's all about fighting for change to the whole system.
Каждая организация, каждая, поверьте, сейчас в России вот такое время, когда каждая организация, чем бы она ни занималась,
every organization right now in Russia, no matter what they work on, have to make a choice. Whether it's the environment, cats, dogs, they all have to make a choice. It's not about the torture. We have many problems here in Russia. We have problems with animals, with trash, with environment, with everything. Now, if you work on cleaning lawns, you won't have problems. But if you ask, damn it, why are the lawns so messed up and dirty? Why are the trees being cut down in the cities where people can't breathe? Why are we polluting our lakes? If you ask these questions publicly, you are screwed. Cats, dogs, doesn't matter. You will immediately become a foreign agent. You will be accused of God knows what, to the point where they can just throw you in jail.
Вы немедленно станете иностранным агентом, вас обвинят черти в чем, и вплоть до того, что посадить могут.
It is really hard to imagine dealing with that kind of constant pressure. Just imagine what that must feel like if you're a young activist working in politics in Russia.
Right, and that's exactly what we're going to find out tomorrow.
The world's Daniel Hoffman there. He produced our series this week on the generation of Russians who've known only Vladimir Putin as their leader. Our thanks also to reporter and producer Charles Maines in Moscow.
Tomorrow on The World, Daniel and I take a deep dive into Russian politics. We travel to three different cities to meet young people, activists, with strong views. Putin's power inspires loyalty among many young Russians, but his political rival, Alexei Navalny, also has a strong base. And Navalny supporters see their guy as a check on corruption and authoritarian rule.
I would like to see other people, but for now, it's great that we have at least one person who does that much.
Young Russians talk about their country, how it's led, and how they think it ought to be led. 30 years ago tonight, student-led protests in the Chinese capital were brought to a shocking and bloody end. After weeks of demonstrations, the People's Liberation Army turned its guns on protesters outside of Tiananmen Square. Much of the rest of the world watched in horror as it played out in the news.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting.
The BBC's Kate Adey was there.
After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
A huge volley of shots just as I left the front line caused panic.
It's easy enough to find out what happened during the Tiananmen crackdown in 1989. Go on YouTube, read news stories about the 30th anniversary. But not if you're in China. 6-4 or June 4th is one of the most politically sensitive phrases in the People's Republic. There's a censorship ban on pretty much all information about the Tiananmen massacre. But many Chinese people, of course, do manage to learn about what happened. Yang Cheng is a scientist born and raised in China. She's currently a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University. So, Yang, you were born the year of Tiananmen Square. How did you discover kind of the truth about 6-4?
So I first heard about 6-4 very randomly at a middle school English class when the teacher was trying to comment about the fate of a local university because it was impacted by the fallout of the late 1980s student pro-democracy movement. And when he just said the word 6-4 without any explanation or any context, and there was no follow-up. So I tried to ask my mother after dinner, and my mother basically gave a very simple, matter-of-fact, but also very stern response. She was like, "Students protested in the streets." And then in a very low voice, "I heard that the government opened fire." And then to shut down this whole conversation, certain things could never be said. Your teacher was too young. And that was the first and last time I asked about the state or the events around it when I was still in China.
You also wrote about the government in your diary. I think you learned another lesson from your parents about that as well.
Yes, and that's something I remember so well because I was only 8 years old when there was the first major Chinese leadership transition that spring. And so I saw it on the news and I heard some of the names, Li Peng, Zhu Rongji. I didn't really understand what their roles were. And I heard some of the names repeated at the family dinner table on the weekend. So I was very excited and I just wrote about it in my diary. And the next day, my mother just crossed all those lines out with the darkest of ink. And I was only upset that she read my diary without my permission. But instead, it was a very important lesson for me that my mother taught me. You must never talk about the government, let alone put it in writing. You never know when the Cultural Revolution might happen again. And so the first time I actually learned about the truth behind the Tiananmen crackdown was after I've come to the United States in the fall of 2009 for graduate school.
And you found this documentary film about the Tiananmen protests and the crackdown called The Gate of Heavenly Peace. It is a powerful film, but for you, watching those scenes from that crackdown, what was going through your head?
This was an event, in a way, it was on one hand full of hope. On the other hand, it started with a state funeral with the death of former general secretary. And so the theme of death and remembrance was carried through this whole protest. And then later, students were putting on white ribbons with the word hunger strike on their foreheads, vowing that they are willing to give up their lives for freedom. So it was incredibly moving. And then finally, towards the later part of the film, when it was showing footage of the night of carnage. And I wrote an essay as well that was when a dam just broke inside me because it exceeded my wildest imaginations of what the government had done and what it was capable of doing.
That essay you wrote, Yang Yang, is at the China File website, and reading it kind of made me wonder how Tiananmen is viewed today. Let me bring in the China File editor, Susan Jakes. Susan, you put out a call for younger Chinese to give their own personal accounts about how they came to learn about this forbidden subject of Tiananmen. What kind of responses did you get?
So we were interested in hearing more stories like the one that Yang Yang just told from people who either hadn't yet been born in 1989 and grew up in China's education system, or maybe were very young, too young to have any kind of memories themselves. And another thing that really struck me in a lot of the accounts we received is the role of parents and the way parents struggle with the danger of telling their children and the risks of not telling their children the truth. So, you know, as parents in America, we might ask ourselves when it's appropriate to tell our kids about disturbing things, about violence or about injustice. But for parents in China post-1989, that's a question that's much more complicated because, you know, your child possessing that knowledge might impact their safety or the safety of your family. But I think what's really interesting is that ignorance can also entail danger. So one of the people that wrote in to us tells the story of her father, who was a journalist, and he comes home to their dinner table one night, and she's a journalism student at the time, and he's just heard that a Chinese newspaper had run a classified ad that read, "Paying tribute to the strong mothers of June 4th victims." And the newspaper editor in charge of reviewing and censoring the ad had let it run because she was young and she had no idea what it meant because she hadn't been taught in school. And then the father who's a journalist, says to his daughter, "I hope you're never stupid enough to do something like this. How could this editor have never heard of June 4th? And the daughter looks up at her dad and says, "What's June 4th? And he realizes that he's never told her himself.
Yang Yang Cheng, I'm curious, 30 years later, how much does this story still matter for people in China? Like, is there interest to know the truth?
I actually think there is a lot of curiosity, not just in the sense of the government's reactions and the bloody crackdown itself, but the whole protest and its aftermath. There is a lot of lessons that could have been learned had history being recorded and open for discussion and study. And so I think in a way, both the Chinese public and the Chinese academia, including the Chinese leadership, are being denied this incredible opportunity to learn from their own past and learn from what this country has experienced so that there could be more hope and a better pathway for the future.
I'm curious, if you were living in China today, and I don't know if you've got children, but if you had a child, would you tell them, as your parents told you, don't write 6-4 in a diary, don't write about the government in your diary, basically don't think about Tiananmen?
Yeah, so first of all, I am not a mother, so I think this is purely my speculation. So I'll put it this way. When my mother tried to censor my diary or forbid any discussion of not just 6-4, but any discussion of politics. And in a way, that was like a mother's way of protecting her child when she saw the Chinese government, almost like the forces of nature that can be just as cruel and also can be just as undefiable. But I would like to hope that with my personality and also with what I have known now, that it's a burden, a moral duty to carry on this memory. And I am a particle physicist, so my profession, I'm basically a historian and a record keeper of the universe. My profession studies the origin and the evolution of our cosmos by observing these tiny wrinkles in light and heat in our universe and recreating some of that conditions in our lab. So in that way, I do feel that I have a responsibility to our cosmological history. I also have a responsibility to the history of my country and my people. And so I would like to hope that there is an opportunity to share this information with my children if I were ever to become a mother, or simply just to keep this memory alive. so that our own bodies and our minds are a vessel for not just remembrance, but resistance against state power and time itself.
That's Yangyang Cheng, scientist at Cornell, who wrote an essay on how she came to understand the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989. Susan Jakes is an editor at China File. We leave it there on this 30th anniversary of Tiananmen. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.